What about Eros? Love. The fourth talk in a series titled Love, Sex, and Marriage was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 19, 2005, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We're going to talk about love, romance, infatuation, those sorts of issues. It could all go under the topic of eros, but I think I need to explain what eros is. Eros, of course, is a Greek word that is translated love. Oftentimes, in this day and age, because of the association with erotic, we think of eros as pertaining to physical desire, sexual attraction, sexual desire, that sort of thing. But that's not fundamentally what eros meant in the Greek. They had another word for that. Eros, if you read Plato, for example, the ultimate object of eros is goodness itself, that you can be in love with goodness, so you can have this desire for the good, that which is right, that which is just, that which is beautiful. And that's the fundamental meaning of eros, is this longing or desire to enjoy, desire to be associated with something. I think this is a very important topic for us in our culture because probably for a long time, but certainly for as long as I've lived, there has been an incredibly strong mythology in our culture, the mythology of love. Love makes the world go round. Love is what gives meaning to life. Love is what conquers all. No matter how hard life might be, no matter how meaningless it may seem, no matter how much we're overwhelmed by the chaos of life, every movie ends with love solving the problem. I didn't know life had any meaning until that man or woman came into my life and I fell in love with them, and then I knew what life was all about. That's such a strong, strong current in our culture. It probably goes back hundreds of years. I think love has been a universal human phenomenon, but only in more recent times have we had a philosophical perspective that has elevated love to the kind of the center of human existence as that which should be the goal of our existence and will give meaning to our existence. Well, what complicates matters is love in English is such an ambiguous term that, I mean, there's a sense in which, from a biblical perspective, isn't love the whole point? Well, yes. So it sort of rings true and resonates with us, but the problem is what the Bible means by love and what we mean by love in the context of our movies and novels are two very, very different things. So let me start by just simply talking about what we mean by the term love in our various usages of it. On the one hand, love can denote a moral commitment of one kind or another, a moral commitment to God, to obey God, to serve God, to know Him and respect Him. It's what the Bible calls the love of God. The Bible is not talking about a desire, I don't think, primarily. It's not talking about an affection. It's not even really talking about an emotion of any kind whatsoever. It's really more a moral, rational recognition of the value of God and a commitment to act accordingly. We are to love God, the Bible says, in that sense. We are to love my neighbor in that same sense. Not that I have to like my neighbor. It's not an affection, not an emotion, but it's a commitment to have their best interest in mind and to desire that good happen to them and that I promote their good. In the context of marriage, I am to love my spouse, to love my wife or love my husband, in this sense, in the sense of making a rational and moral commitment to know them, respect them, be faithful to them, promote their good and their well-being, that should be the foundation of any marriage, is that sort of love. So in that sense, of course, love is central to marriage and the man-woman relationship. That's true. But we're not talking about any feelings, any emotions, any affection, any desire, nothing like that. We're talking about something not nearly as spectacular and dramatic and wonderful feeling, but we're talking about something very substantive. A moral commitment is about as substantive as you can get. But we use the word love to describe that. On the other hand, we also use the word love to describe an emotional state or an emotional response of one kind or another. It can be affection. I love my brother. I love my friend. It can be delight when I love my infant child and they make me giggle. I'm delighted with them. But I can also be delighted at inanimate objects or something that somebody says. Lots of things can delight me. But we would use the word love to describe that. I just love it when you smile like that. I just love it when you say things like that. Just an act can be the object of my delight. Just some sort of pleasure, any sort of pleasure in relationship to another person or thing, we would oftentimes use the word love to describe that. Or we can use love in the context of what I want to talk about tonight, what I will call infatuation, which is a very unique and special kind of feeling that we have toward other people. I'll define that a little bit later. We use love to describe an instinctual attachment. The love of a father for his children or a mother for her children goes even deeper than feelings. It's instinctual. It's a bond that is just built in there by biology itself, I think. And yet we use the word love to define it. Or it can be simply a kind of intellectual appreciation, something synonymous with respect. I can say to someone, I love you, and what I mean by that is I respect you. I hold you in high regard. But it wouldn't be altogether odd in certain contexts to use the word love to define that. So that's a wide range of phenomena, of experiences that all get the same English word attached to them. And it's very, very confusing. There are a lot of problems that arise from that ambiguity. The most important problem for our purposes tonight is the confusion that gets fostered when we say that marriage is based on love. Love is the foundation of marriage. Well, on the one hand, that's incredibly true. As I just said earlier, I need to make a commitment to my wife to promote her well-being, to respect her, to know her, to care for her. That moral commitment that I make, regardless of how I might feel, regardless of whether I'm happy with her or unhappy with her, whether I like her right now or don't like her right now, none of that stuff ultimately matters. I'm making a commitment to promote her well-being, to love her. And that, of course, in that sense, of course, marriage, love is absolutely foundational to marriage. Without that kind of love, marriage can't last. It can't survive. Certainly can't thrive without love as a foundation in that sense. But that's not what most people understand us to mean by that, especially in our culture because of the mythology that's in our culture. We think that we mean love in some sort of emotional sense, and especially we tend to think that the foundation of marriage is this thing that we call being in love. Having fallen in love, we now love the other person, the other man or woman, and that is going to be the foundation of marriage. Well, that, as I will try to explain, is a huge, huge mistake. Love in that sense could never, ever possibly be the foundation of marriage. Marriage can't thrive on that foundation because it is such a flimsy, insubstantial foundation. What happens, of course, is this person that I am in love with and marry, I am soon no longer in love with in the same sense, for reasons that I will go on to explain. But if love is the foundation of marriage, that what we do in our culture is rationalize that it's no longer appropriate that I am married to them. It's no longer suitable. It's no longer fitting that I be married to them because the love is gone. And if the love is gone, the basis for marriage is gone, so I guess we better get a divorce. And that, I think, is not an uncommon phenomenon in our culture. I think that's the reason for divorce, oftentimes, even if that's not the articulated reason for divorce, is that's what we're thinking in our heads. So I want to concentrate on this thing called eros in the sense of what I call infatuation. It otherwise goes by the phrase being in love or falling in love. Now, I'm going to call it infatuation. I don't want you to be confused by that. There's two forms of infatuation. There's the adolescent version of eros, and then there's the adult version of eros. The adolescent version of eros is what we normally call infatuation, and we're kind of we're trying to diminish it as what we used to call puppy love. I don't know if that's still a phrase that's used any longer, but back in the day we called that adolescent version of eros puppy love, because it's sort of unsophisticated and immature and ridiculous. I mean, it's just silly, and it expresses itself in a silly way. As we grow into adulthood, we're not so silly about it, and we're more sophisticated about it, but I would argue that the feelings that are underlying it are the same thing as the adolescent experiences for the first time in their life. And so if I call it infatuation, I'm just as interested in the adult version of that as I am in the adolescent version of that. Either one of them can be described fundamentally in the way I'm going to go on to describe it here. As I said, it's not animal desire, it's not sexual lust that we're talking about. Rather, eros is a very, very noble feeling. But I underline the word feeling. It is fundamentally a feeling that happens to us, comes upon us. Some of the best descriptions of eros that I have ever read are in the Symposium by Plato. He's talking about not a heterosexual relationship, but a homosexual relationship there. But if you translate it into a heterosexual relationship, it describes very much the phenomenon that all of our movies are all about. It's a very noble feeling that makes me feel like I want nothing else for the other, the man or woman that I'm in love with, except for him or her to be happy. And there's something very noble feeling about it, such that we feel like I am so much in love with them that even if my love is unrequited, even if they don't return the love toward me, I just want them to be happy. And even if they find happiness with someone else rather than me, I want them to be happy. And it's this feeling that I have that delights, that would want to promote their happiness and their joy. It makes me feel like, now let me back up. In everything that I'm about to say here, what I'm saying is, it's a noble feeling that makes me feel like I want nothing else except for them to be happy. Is it a commitment that I want nothing else for them but their happiness? No. It's only a feeling. And it's crucial to understand the distinction. It's one thing to make a commitment to promote somebody's well-being. It's another thing to feel like I want their well-being. And oftentimes people who feel this out of love don't necessarily act accordingly, but they certainly feel like that's what they want for the other person. Infatuation, eros, is the feeling that makes me feel like I would do absolutely anything for the other person. I would even die for them. It's a feeling that makes me feel like I want nothing. I already said that. Okay. It's a feeling that makes me feel like I want to serve the other person for all time. I don't want them to serve me. I just want to serve them. I'll just do anything for them. It's a feeling that makes me feel like I want to share all that I have and all that I am with the other person. It's a feeling that makes me feel like I need the other person to serve him or her and make him or her happy in order to be happy myself. My happiness is going to be found in their happiness, and their happiness is going to be found by my meeting their needs. And I need to do that. It's all those rock and roll songs. I want you. I need you. I want nothing more. It makes me feel like I want nothing more than to be in his or her presence. I just want to gaze upon them. I just want to take in their being, observe their being, and that alone delights me and makes me happy. It is the feeling that I don't need anything but him or her to be happy. I don't need money, I don't need fame, I don't need success, I don't need anything else. I just need that person. It's the feeling that makes me feel like I want to never be parted from him or her, for all time, forever. There's even a hurt or an ache or a longing when I'm apart from the other person. That, call it love sickness, where when I'm infatuated with someone, it just rips me apart to be separated from the other person. It's that feeling that makes me feel like I could never possibly feel any other way. I will never feel anything but this love for that person ever, ever again, because this is forever. This is eternal. This is what we call true love. Not like that, all those false loves that I felt the other 20 times before. This is true love. And how do I know this is true love? Well, it feels that way. Well, what's going on here? I can't prove this. I don't have any empirical evidence for this, but I strongly suspect that this is a universal human phenomenon. Even back in the days when you had arranged marriages and you didn't have the mythology that we have that makes love the foundation for the whole institution of marriage, you still had people falling in love with each other across and in spite of the various marriage institutions and relationships. There was still this phenomenon of falling in love, I think. What is it? My contention is I would define eros as a God-given, God-created, organic drug. A drug, a hallucinogenic drug, if you will, that creates in me this feeling that carries with it a kind of vision or hallucination of a sort of real and true dream of the joy of marital commitment. In order, I think God gave us this to open us up to the possibility of a commitment that otherwise we would be daunted by. We'd be scared to death to make this marriage commitment, if not opened up to the possibility by the effects of this drug. If we go back and those things that I listed in terms of what does it make you feel like, if we were to analyze it, I think what we would find that it makes you feel like you want to be committed in the way the Bible has defined marriage. A forever commitment, to death do us part type of commitment. I am going to commit my life to you to the end of my days. That's supposed to be what the marriage commitment is all about. Well, interestingly, this drug makes you feel like that would be a delightful possibility. This is forever. This is never going to end. This is an unending feeling that I have. Makes me, it sort of mimics the nature of the commitment that God intended marriage to be. The finding delight in serving the other person. Well, what is the marriage commitment except a commitment to be for the other, to love them, to serve them, to respect them, to know them, to honor them, and so on? The love makes us feel like that would be a source of happiness and joy and delight. You, when you are in love, it is to you and you only that I am in love. It seems to be very, very unique and specific to an individual, at least at any given time. Why is it a feeling? I mean, I don't fall in love with humanity that way. I fall in love with you in this particular way. Why? Because again, I think it's mimicking the nature of the marriage commitment as God intended marriage to be, unique to one individual. And we could go right down the line, but I think it would be interesting to analyze all those things that we say, all those things that we think, all those things that we feel when we are in love. And I think we would find an important analog between those feelings and the true character of the marriage commitment as God intended it to be. So what I'm arguing is that I think God gave us this phenomenon of being in love as a way of expanding our consciousness away from ourselves, outside of our own little self-contained world, and opening up our mind to the possibility of being there committed for life to another person, and seeing that as a delightful and joyous thing, not as a drag of one kind or another. Now, I think God's intention was that he would give us this drug to motivate us toward making the commitment of marriage. What seems to be in the very nature of the drug is it's only temporary. It wears off. It goes away. And the mundaneness of life is a very incredible antidote to this drug that just quickly wipes it right away. So that everyone's experience, I think everyone's experience when they get married, is that several months into the marriage, all of a sudden, they don't feel the same way that they did when they were in love and out of that love had decided to commit their life to the other person. If people are not prepared for the evaporation of the effects of that drug, they wake up and they go, oh no, what did I do? I married the wrong person. My true love wasn't true love. My true love was false love. It failed me. It faked me out. I married the wrong person. And then any number of things can happen depending upon how much character and how mature the people are. Hopefully, we as believers can be a little bit better equipped than that and recognize that that's all mythology anyway. As wonderful as love is, and there's no more wonderful feeling in the world, from my experience, although I haven't done a lot of synthetic drugs, but in fact, caffeine is my repertoire. But in my experience, there's no more wonderful feeling than being in love. But it is so fragile, and it is so tenuous, and ultimately it is so insubstantial. There is nothing there except a pipe dream that affects the way that I feel. So God's intention is that we give substance to our relationships, not that we find substance in this illusion of love, but that we give substance to the relationship by making the commitment. By making the commitment that the drug points to in his work, Either Or, there's some wonderful passages by Kierkegaard on the eternality of the marriage commitment. And what he means by the eternality of it is what I would call commitment. That what makes it last and what makes it substantive and what makes it valuable and what makes it important is that it's not just a fleeting pleasure of the moment, but it's a commitment to another person on the long haul. Well, that's substantive, and we create that through the decision that we make to be committed and to follow through on our commitment to the other person. So, in terms of the ethics of this thing, I would say it's just flat out wrong to base my decision to marry someone on the basis of eros. It cannot last, and it cannot support the relationship. The problems of two people becoming one are too big of a problem, too big of an obstacle for something as fragile as eros to be able to overcome. It's wrong, therefore, I would argue, not only to base marriage and get married on the basis of eros, but it's wrong to try to prolong eros in the marriage relationship. You can go to any Christian bookstore, and I guarantee you, you're going to find some book there on how to make love last in your marriage. and basically tips on romancing one another in order to keep the romance alive. And if you're like me, we don't blink an eye. That is so much a part of our culture that our response is, well, of course you'd want to keep the romance alive. Why wouldn't you want to keep the romance alive? Well, I think it's wrong. Because to keep the romance alive is to try to remain in a fantasy and not be grounded in reality. The purpose is not to experience romance. The purpose is to carry out, act out, and honor our commitments to one another. It's terribly wrong to base the decision as to who I'm going to marry on the basis of eros alone. Now, I think eros plays a role. I think it should play a role. I don't know that it has to play a role, but it typically will play some sort of role. So there's nothing wrong with eros coming into the picture and being a factor, but to make that the only basis for deciding to marry someone is a huge mistake. It doesn't have enough substance to be the basis for that decision. The decision has to be a decision I make in wisdom about the character of the other person. Do I know the other person to know that they will be my friend and that I will be their friend? Because friendship and respect are a much firmer foundation for the commitment than eros could ever hope to be. It's wrong to use eros as a justification for sexual intimacy. Now, I don't know what it's like these days with you younger generation, but in my generation, eros was its own justification for being sexually intimate. Marriage was not a good justification, but eros was. You were supposed to be sexually intimate with the one you were in love with. What's that song? No, that's not actually making my point. What's that? If you can't be with the one you love, then love the one you're with. That was going a little further. But the equation between love and sexual intimacy in our mythology is very, very tight. That's false. From a biblical perspective, the reason for sexual intimacy is the marriage commitment. That's what makes sexual intimacy appropriate. But apart from and outside of the marriage commitment, I don't care how strongly you feel in love with someone, that's no reason to sleep with them. Quite apart from sexual intimacy, it's also wrong to pursue a romantic relationship with a member of the opposite sex. Oftentimes, even in Christian culture, we're inclined to think that the problem with adultery is physical intimacy with the other person, literal sexual intimacy physically. But it's equally problematic to allow myself to become romantically attached with someone that I am not married to. I think there's such a thing as emotional adultery, not just physical adultery, but emotional adultery. And likewise, I think there's not only physical fornication, but emotional fornication, where I simply allow myself to become emotionally involved and attached and fantasize a sort of committed type relationship with another person and behave accordingly and have the expectations that arise out of that with a member of the opposite sex, even though I have made no promises and there are no commitments. Well, that's inappropriate. When I feel the tug of love, it raises the question, do you want to commit your life to that person? But it doesn't answer the question. You have to answer the question. Love doesn't answer that for you. So love is not automatically a reason to allow myself to let myself go emotionally and be taken up with a fantasy of a relationship with the other person. I would argue that romantic relationships can be just as much a form of sensuality as sexuality and sexual fantasy itself and sexual desire itself. Because, as I say, I think there are people in this world that are addicted to love, addicted to romance. You often see, this seems more characteristic of women than men. I don't know, maybe not. But no, I've known both, who will go from one relationship to the next relationship until the love wears off. and then they will leave that person, dump them, and fall in love with somebody else. And then dump them and fall in love with somebody else. I think they're just addicted to the feeling of being in love. And that can happen even when there's no physical intimacy whatsoever in the relationship. But it's just as wrong, I think, as sexual fornication. And it's just as much a pursuit of sensuality, liking the effects of the drug and going for the hit of the drug itself rather than looking at what the drug is supposed to mean and what the true substance of the relationship is supposed to be about. Let me be clear about what I'm not saying. When I talk about love and romance and infatuation fading when you get married, I'm not saying that there is no emotional delight or joy or pleasure to marriage. I'm not saying marriage is just one drag. I mean, there's no more delightful part of my life than my marriage to Jody. I love being married. I love our relationship. I love everything that it gives me and brings me. But it's not the same as when I was in love with her. I mean, the emotions are not the same. They're quieter. They're not nearly as wild and all-consuming, and I'm not nearly as obsessed with her as I was when I was in love with her. I mean, I can actually function in this world in a way that I couldn't. But even though the emotion is different, it's still very much a joy and a delight. So I'm not saying that there's something wrong if you enjoy your marriage. I'm not saying that at all. But it's not infatuation. It's not eros. That's a whole different phenomenon. Okay, questions? Come.
You say that love is the drug that gets you over that hump of getting involved in a relationship that if you really looked at it, you wouldn't.
Nobody in their right mind would get married.
So it seems to me that's sort of a mind trap, a sort of deceitful trick that our nature plays on us. It pumps us up with this drug to get us to do something that when the drug wears off, we have to come up with another reason to keep doing it.
Yeah, it does sound like that's what I'm saying, doesn't it? The difference is, you know, a synthetic drug makes reality look other than it actually is. I think the genius of this drug is it makes reality look like it really is, but we would be not open to, out of the little cocoon of our selfhood, if we didn't get something to get us started thinking along those lines. But the point is, I think it's pointing in the direction of something true, not something untrue, not something false. Namely, the commitment of marriage itself is a delight. It is worth it. It is something I want to do. It is something that I will be glad that I did. And eros can get me pointed thinking in that direction, I think.
Is the difference between the moral person, their rationality, or their willing to shoulder the load that they now discover that they committed to? Does a rational and moral person sitting next to an irrational and immoral person, and they look at their thoughts, their desire, are they both having the same basic experience?
Give me a context. I'm not. No.
Two guys sitting on the park bench talking about their girlfriend.
Okay.
Oh, she's great. Yeah, she's great. So they just keep echoing each other's comments. And one person has the moral structure that when the love wears off, they're out of it. And the other person has the moral structure that when the love wears off, they say, "Oh, thrill is gone." Why then do they continue to do it if it's not what they want? Maybe I'm not asking this right. Is the moral rational person looking forward and realizing someday this thrill will be gone?
Yeah.
Someday I won't feel like this, and she won't light up the room, and her breath will be, you know, mint and lilac, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that's okay,
because having thought about this, having been prompted to think about it by the fact that I've fallen in love with her, I know that I won't always feel like this, but actually, when it comes right down to it, I want to make that kind of commitment. I want to be there for her always. And I know it'll be hard. I know. Well, it depends how deep you want to go. I mean, hopefully...
She's my best, or he or she is my best friend.
Yeah.
Because they're a fascinating person. I love being around them. Is it still a selfish thing? Or is it...
Okay.
Someone should love them, so I'm going to take the job.
Yeah. Well, it's still... I don't know if I want to use the word selfish. It's still mysterious. Why do we love the people we love with this kind of love? That's why the mythology of Cupid, I mean, it's almost inexplicable. I mean, it's like I was walking down the street and I got struck by an arrow and I fell in love with somebody that, you know, who knows why I'm in love with them. I don't think we can explain it, but I lost my point.
Why? Because she's so fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That there's no reason in principle, it seems to me, why I couldn't make a commitment to any female on the planet. I could just simply, I mean, other than the fact that they wouldn't love me, but I mean...
You can make a commitment to a refrigerator. I
mean, yeah.
But that's not what a marriage is. It's just...
Right, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. That a huge component in the marriage commitment is I need to want to make this commitment. I need to want to spend the rest of my life becoming one with them, getting to know them, serving them, and so on. So, you know, if someone doesn't want to marry me, I shouldn't be slighted by that. I mean, that's what we're tempted to think, is I've been rejected. That is, I'm not good enough. There's something wrong with me. Love is too mysterious to draw that conclusion. Just because someone has not wanted to spend their life with me and be committed to me doesn't mean that I'm somehow deficient. It just means it didn't happen. It wasn't in the cards as God shuffled them. Well, what is it that makes me want to be committed to someone? Well, I don't know. I mean, exactly. Except, yes, they're intriguing. I feel at home with them. I mean, that was the case with Jody, is that for me, I just felt at home with her. I felt like I knew her and that she knew me. I didn't and she didn't, but but I felt like that. And those are the kinds of things that, I mean, that's still true. I mean, that wasn't part of the infatuation. That was part of the friendship, the connection that got formed because the infatuation drove me to get to know her a little bit better. And it was underlying that something more substantive took place. We became friends. I just woke up one day and realized she's my best friend. Why wouldn't I want to, I mean, who better to spend the rest of your life with than my best friend?
Seems to me God spends a whole lot more time talking about, you know, adultery, fornication, you know, et cetera, than he is talking about, you know, unjust weights and measures.
Okay.
Moving someone's property.
Okay.
Water, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Yeah. Well, my theory is that what we all share in common is a basic underlying humanity. Then half the human race splits off. Are female and half are male, and you can't get any deeper into who we are than our sexuality. I mean, the only way you can go deeper is into our humanity itself, into our common humanity itself. But one layer above that is our sexuality, and there's this fundamental difference between us, and there's this fundamental issue with respect to the very nature of my being is my sexuality. So when my life goes wrong and when I am in rebellion against God, my sexuality is one of the most powerful arenas of my rebellion, I think, if I'm addressing your question. I mean, is that...
You may have said something about this, but could you say something about how to deal with when this feeling hits you and you just know it's not appropriate, whether you're some situation where you're married or somehow committed,
mm-hmm.
Otherwise,
what do you do? Mm-hmm. The most important thing we can do is know that it doesn't mean anything. And that's what our culture leaves us so ill-equipped to do, is to know that this is just some bizarre drug reaction and I just need to let it go and let it pass. It'll go away. I know it'll go away, so don't act on it. Several years into my marriage with Jody, we met this new couple, and I don't know what it was, but just I felt that kind of intrigue with the woman. And it was a very interesting experience for me because I could see where if someone didn't believe what I believed, I can see where it could have taken them. You know, being intrigued by the woman, you pursue it, you spend time, you try to foster it, you try to promote it, you try to keep it alive, and, you know, pretty soon you've got a full-blown adulterous relationship going on, probably. But fortunately, I mean, I had thought through some of these things at that point, and I could just kind of look at it and go, wow, that's bizarre. I don't even know her. You know, where is that coming from? This is bizarre. I didn't act on it, and didn't do anything with it, and sure enough, it wore off, and it was not a problem. But if I had thought that if I believed the mythology of our day, I would have said, oh, maybe this is the woman for me because I'm in love with her. That's only going to get you in trouble. So we have to become convinced that love is not this infatuation, this eros, is no substantive connection with another human being. It just isn't. But if I believe that it is, I'm going to act on it, and I'm going to act to my own destruction.
Because it is, I mean, you read books, The Bridges of Madison County, all these different things where mm-hmm. it is so romanticized, whether the people go off and leave their spouse or not, or whatever it is. It's so romanticized.
Right. And the message we get from those books is that even if tragically, for cultural reasons, they don't commit adultery and they stay with their spouse instead, oh, what an incredible sacrifice, because they were really in love with the other person. I mean, they're actually turning it on its head, and they're saying the substantive relationship was the relationship of infatuation, and the non-substantive relationship was the marriage they were in. That's completely backwards. And it's an incredible lie, an incredible myth, and an incredible fantasy that we believe to our own cultural destruction.
You made a comment about how the idea of keeping the romance alive is wrong, like that kind of perspective. And I was wondering if you could maybe talk about that a little bit more, because I guess my understanding of that, which is probably very small, is that it's not so much like trying to keep this infatuation feelings as much as it is trying to like actually foster a relationship, because I think a lot of people get married and don't take care of their relationship, and that seems to be the focus of a lot of those kinds of phrases and books and conferences and stuff like that, is to actually foster, like, you have to like keep up on your relationship versus just let it go. And so I was wondering if maybe you had a different...
Well, if that is what they mean and that's all they mean, then I don't have any problem with that. I mean, yes, I didn't take a vow to neglect you forever. When I was marrying Jody, you don't get married and then take the other person for granted. That's a violation of your marriage vow. So even though it's an incredible temptation, but so if someone is just suggesting that you keep your vow, and the trouble with that is I have a little bit of trouble with giving practical advice about how to do that. I mean, it's not like... The reason I take my wife for granted is because I can't think of any way. I can't think of anything to do. It's because I'm being a jerk. It's because I'm just not paying attention to the relationship. If I change my mind and decide I need to take this seriously, I need to do right by her, I can probably think of a couple things to do, a couple places to go, ways of expressing my affection, my commitment to her. I don't lack for ideas. I lack for the character to be thoughtful enough and sensitive enough to actually keep my vow. So I don't really need a book to tell me that. I just need somebody to kick me and wake me up. So and then there is another element to a lot of those, but it's been a long time, and maybe the books these days are different, but there was a book that came out in the 60s called Total Woman, and part of that was about keeping the love alive. I mean, this is a Christian book, right? And there are things like strip naked, wrap yourself in cellophane, and meet your husband at the door wrapped in cellophane. Well, come on. and other stuff like that, that was clearly, I think, catering to the times, to the culture at large and the times. It was, just because you're a Christian doesn't mean you can't be just as committed to sensuality as the culture around you. So let's just, as Christians, be committed to sensuality together rather than go looking outside of our marriages for it. Well, that's not right. We're committed to a whole different set of values. Sensuality is not that important to us. We'll have plenty of sensual experiences. They'll be there, little serendipitous gifts from God, but we don't need to make it the sum and substance of our relationship.
And then also with just emotional fornication, like we just talked about it briefly, could you summarize again, like, what exactly you think that is?
What do I mean?
Yeah.
I don't mean friendship. Nothing wrong with friendship, so I would distinguish it from that. But where fatuation becomes emotional fornication, let me see, I have a definition here. It's having the kind and degree of emotional commitment to and dependence upon another person that corresponds to the kind and degree of emotional commitment and dependence that someone would have if they were committed in marriage. So it's a relationship that sort of mimics marriage, the expectations of marriage, the desires of marriage, but especially the expectations of marriage. When I enter into a relationship with somebody of the opposite sex and I expect them to give me the kind of emotion, time, emotional commitment and so on that I would expect of a wife or husband, that's what I'm talking about. Probably without the sexual intimacy, without the physical intimacy, that's a whole other problem. But even without that, if I'm expecting them to be my lover in all other respects, then why? Where did they promise anything? Where did that come from?
First, a comment, kind of to Melody and in general. I was always really confused about the emotional fornication thing that you're describing until a friend of mine described it as, it makes sense that you would expect a friend to be committed to you as a friend.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, as distant or as close of a friendship as you have, it would make sense to be as committed, to expect as much commitment as that friendship is. And then, you know, and then you have marriage and those commitments and such. So it's not that, like, no commitment or all commitment. Like, there's commitments involved in friendship as well.
Right.
And that's not a problem.
Right. Yeah.
I also have a few questions.
Okay. Can I just hitchhike on that? That the thing that's peculiar about their marriage relationship is it's exclusive. See, in a friendship, if I have a friendship with you, and we have and it may be a fairly high level of commitment because we're good friends, but you don't get jealous if I also have a friendship with another woman, if we're just friends. But if you're my wife, you don't expect me to have the same kind of intimate relationship with another woman that I have with you, then you get jealous, and rightly so. I mean, that jealousy is appropriate because as my wife, you belong to me and only me. You are the exclusive person of my loyalty. So, but what happens in emotional fornication is we have expectations of that kind of exclusivity of the other person. And that's the first tip-off in my mind that we're not dealing with friendship, is when it gets possessive, when it gets exclusive.
You probably said this, but I want you to say it again.
Okay.
Okay. So you said, like, eros is what makes us get over the dread of marriage. And you said...
Did I say dread?
I used to use some word like that.
Because we're daunted by it.
Oh, that was the word, yes. The daunt. But you also said eros isn't necessary.
Right.
So, close the gap.
Well, back to Logan's question, ideally, we get up to speed not after we're married and the drug wears off and then we all of a sudden have to get up to speed. Hopefully we get up to speed before that. We come to realize going into the marriage, this isn't going to last. I mean, this feels great and it's wonderful, but it's not going to last. And yet we recognize it's a commitment I want to get into for life anyway. I want to. I mean, I'm not dreading it. I want to do this thing. So could you decide that and make that decision and make that decision to marry this particular person and not be feeling eros? I think so, yeah.
Do you think that you would have to have, like, I mean, at the same time, though, you say, like, you want to. So you'd have to have, I mean, you'd have to have some of the
Yeah, there's some level of, there's something that motivates me, exactly. But it doesn't have to be eros, I don't think. It could just be friendship. And in fact, I'm inclined to think probably the older we get, the less, I mean, and unless we have become addicted to eros and are pursuing eros and are eros fiends of some kind or another, probably the older we get, the less significant eros is.
It makes sense to me that love is not, eros is not just like, just because you feel that for someone doesn't mean that you have, that you...
I'm sorry, just because you what?
Just because you feel that for someone doesn't mean that you necessarily are going to get into a relationship with them or anything like that. But what do you do?
Get in a relationship?
No. What do you do when you have those feelings?
Oh.
When it's not necessarily inappropriate, but not necessarily appropriate either?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
well, I would argue that the feelings themselves are never inappropriate per se. It's what I do with them. I don't think I can control the fact that I have those feelings. They're not really under my conscious control. So the fact that I have the feelings is not a moral issue. It's how wisely I act in the throes of those. And that's what you're asking is what do I do with them?
Yeah.
You know, it really depends. I mean, that's where I have to read who am I that's having these feelings and who are they toward? And I mean, if it's a guy, for example, who does... I hadn't finished my sentence. If it's a guy who doesn't have good moral character and is not likely to be someone who's even going to understand what it means to be committed to you and so on, it makes absolutely no sense to give any credence to the feelings at all and pursue the relationship. I mean, why would I want to be committed to someone who's not going to be committed to me, who doesn't even understand what that would mean, and who doesn't have the character to follow through on it? So I need to assess that kind of situation and suffer, and I do mean suffer, because it is a kind of suffering, suffer having that longing, that feeling of longing and aching for another person that I can't do anything about.
I guess another part of that is like, not necessarily even with a person who has some flaw.
Has no what?
Has some flaw like that where they're just like,
uh-huh.
Anyone who wasn't in love with them would obviously see that there's problems with this, but like someone who would make a perfectly good friend, for example. But like, I mean, like, I can have a bunch of friends, but obviously shouldn't be falling in love with all of them. Like, boy, I hope this is more coherent than it sounds to me. But just like, I don't know, what do you do with that?
Well, the same thing, I think. You go ahead and pursue the friendship now because you have a basis for rapport as friends and you can make the commitment of friends to one another. But what you feel is going to want it to be something other and more than that. And again, if something about the relationship, for example, they're not interested in it being anything more than friendship, for example, makes it impossible for it to be anything other than that, then you suffer. You suffer from not being able to have what you long for. You can only have what has been given to you, and you can't have the other thing that you long for instead. And you suffer. some of the best lessons in faith that I ever learned in my life were suffering the unrequited love. I call it unrequited love. I was infatuated and the other person wasn't. because it's suffering, and it's a very intense kind of suffering. And you have to, you know, you go to your knees before God and say, God, you know what I want. And this ain't happening. Do you love me or don't you? I mean, what's with this? And you have to come to terms with your Creator and you as a creature before your Creator. What does this mean? That you would make me suffer in this way, that you wouldn't give me what I want. And some of the most important lessons about God and faith itself were learned because of the suffering that I experienced from being in the throes of infatuation. It's very important that we measure our actions according to what's right, wise and appropriate and loving and good, not according to what I feel. Now, what happens is you eventually get to a point where those match up. What I feel I want and what is wise and appropriate and good and what the other person seems to be, where they seem to be at in terms of the feedback I get from them, is that perhaps they want something more as well. And then in a way that is more mysterious than anything I know, you kind of bumble your way into marriage.
So, what you're saying is any steps towards exclusivity outside of marriage is something that shouldn't happen?
Well, I can't say that because somehow you have to get from not married to married.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. That occurred to you too. So it will happen, but ideally we just want to be wise and loving in the way that we go there. And I don't know any way to do it gracefully. I mean, this will come up later in the class, but I didn't do it gracefully. I don't really know anybody who does that transition gracefully. It's very, very difficult, and it's inherently difficult. I mean, how do you, with the uncertainty of whether you do or do not want to make the commitment, how do you all of a sudden make this commitment that's a lifelong commitment from being single and without any missteps? But just like all of life and all of the Christian faith, the goal is not to get through life without making mistakes. That's not the goal. I mean, sure, we're going to make mistakes, but hopefully we will do it in good faith. That is, hopefully it'll be in the pursuit of that which is wise and good and just and loving. And if we make mistakes, we make mistakes. And that's why we need God's mercy. But
when you were explaining a little bit more about emotional fornication, it seemed like you were implying that, we use the example of how jealousy plays into emotional fornication, and that when we feel jealousy, it seems like that's a sign or something that this is at an unhealthy level, or
well, not necessarily, because you see,
just find that gap that you're saying exists, but is this awkward stage of commitment? I mean, I guess any of us who have been in a relationship have felt jealousy when
right
someone you really care about,
right?
Like, oh man, even basic level of, he stole my friend away, you know, that type of
right
thing. Like anything that you care about, that you can't have as much as you want, you're going to feel jealousy towards. So I guess bridging that gap of the whole dating thing, at what point does that turn into emotional fornication in your mind?
Okay. Yeah, well, some jealousy is just always wrong. I mean, to be jealous toward a friend and for the friendship of a friend is just wrong. That's my problem, not their problem. Because friendship is not the kind of thing that by its very nature ought to be exclusive or needs to be exclusive. I mean, I'm being unduly possessive if I want you for a friend and nobody else can have you for a friend. Then there's something wrong with me. So not all jealousy is necessarily healthy jealousy. So many times our jealousy is perverse. But I do think jealousy, in the sense of, at least in the sense that I mean it, with respect to my spouse, is healthy. It's well founded. they ought to be jealous if I am giving loyalty that belongs, if I'm giving loyalty that belongs to Jody to somebody else, then she has every right to cry foul. That's not appropriate. So that I think is an appropriate kind of jealousy. Well, as we're moving toward marriage, we're going to begin to feel that kind of what I think is basically would be a healthy expression of jealousy if in fact we were married. I'm going to begin to feel that with respect to the person that I'm really getting interested in. When that happens, that needs to tell me, Jack, so who is this person to you? I mean, that's basically what happened to me is I realized I was beginning to think of Jody in those terms and feel very jealous when she would interact with other people and not me. And I realized something's wrong here. Either I need to clarify in my own head what this relationship is really all about, or I need to make a promise to commit my life to her. And it kind of called the question for me. And I think that's the role it will play if, in fact, the relationship is moving toward marriage, and in which case I wouldn't call that emotional fornication. It was just sort of the wake-up to me that I'm moving in that direction and I need to see the handwriting on the wall and act on it. It's when I'm unwilling to act on it, I want the relationship, but I don't want to do anything about it, that it then becomes fraudulent and inappropriate, I think.
One more question. After we have made that commitment, do you think that this infatuation type of love is something that is built into us as sinful people and resurfaces no matter how strong our commitments are? This infatuation that you felt, that you use it as an example with this other woman for this small amount of time, do you think that is something that is bound to come up no matter what? Or do you think that we can, with more commitment that we have, we can repress that and erase that out of our life?
I doubt it. I mean, I think it could always come up. Because I don't...
Out of that biological difference?
Yeah. Whatever causes it, you know. And I don't know what it is. But that's why it's so important to get it in perspective and understand it in perspective and understand how meaningless it is. Is that it? Okay, go and love no more.